The time is December 1996 when horror master Wes Craven directed a redefined slasher movie with a new horror premise, a razor-sharp blend of slasher thrills and self-aware satire. Set in the quiet town of Woodsboro, this film follows high schooler Sydney Prescott, played by Neve Campbell, and her friends as they are stalked by a mass killer called Ghostface, who knows the rules of scary movies all too well. This killer turns the town upside down with a young deputy played by David Arquette and an eager reporter played by Courtney Cox hot on the trail. In this nod to horror cinephiles and slasher movies past, Wes Craven creates a new kind of slasher that not only took audiences by surprise, but would inspire slasher movies in all new directions in the coming years. This week on Back to the Balcony, we discuss 1996, Scream.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
It is that time, my friend. We have held off on horror movie temptations to bring it all to this month. And I figured to kick off October, the Fright Fest, whatever you want to call it, Scream was a good start because its attempt to reinvent the slasher film by making it a slasher film about slasher films is a brilliant starter to this month. And this one, I have to say, this is one I didn't see in theaters, and surprisingly, this is one that I craved over in a normal year to be the one to go see it in theaters, but I just don't know what it was. It was a December release, 5 days before Christmas. We had movies like Mars Attacks, Star Trek First Contact, Jerry Maguire, a lot of fantastic movies in December that I don't know would have thought that would have detracted audiences to go see this movie, and in a way, it wasn't the most successful movie of December, and we haven't discussed this film before, so what'd you think?
Yeah, so I did see this one in the theater. I had the benefit of being a few years older than you, so this came out right at the time where I was like allowed to roam free with my friends, and maybe one kid's older brother had a car and would just take us everywhere. Quick question for you. Did you have dollar theaters in your neighborhoods, in your growing up towns and stuff like that?
We had a $2 theater 2 miles away.
So we had a slew of dollar theaters here in Utah growing up. Like every little city and suburb had at least $1 theater, either like in the dirt mall or like maybe at the end of a strip mall. So me being like 14, 15 when this came out, it was the place where you'd go because you didn't have any money, right? But you could afford a $1.50 movie ticket at the dollar theater. And you would go multiple times, often to the same movie. So I have a very fond memory of this particular era where it was like Mission Impossible, GoldenEye, Scream, Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison. Like we'd see these movies multiple times at $1.50. And no one ever checked IDs back then for us, so we were able to get in no problem. I think the satire and the irony of the film was lost on me as a teenager when this came out. Because when you're younger, you don't realize that it really wasn't a lot of time between the so-called end of the slasher era and this film. It's kind of like The Wedding Singer, right? It came out in, what, 96, 97? So it was only 10 years removed from the decade that it was making fun of, like 86, 87. This is the same thing. This movie's all about the kind of like historical footprint that slasher films had in the early mid 80s, but it's literally the middle of the decade and it's only been 10 years removed. It plays a lot better if you think about it now when we're out of the home video generation into streaming, where people are discovering more slasher films on Tubi and on Amazon Prime and on YouTube. But it works, and that's the genius of this movie. I think Kevin Williamson knocked it right in the head. He knew that this film could play decade after decade after decade and not only maintain that same sense of irony and the satire of the slasher film, but it would just keep getting better as we keep rediscovering and introducing new generations to slasher movies. And I think that is what makes this movie so special, is that it gets better as it ages. I'm not going to say it needs all the sequels, but the original premise just gets better and better.
It needs all the sequels. It really does. Even though they're not great, but it's almost a satire upon a satire of it. But you know what?
Right. The joke keeps going, and that's what makes it good.
Yeah, until they end up in space, and then we'll go from there. But, you know, Williamson, I'm glad you brought that up, because this is one that really did kind of bank in his future career to really go off of that mystery slasher, the audience reaction of who the killer is versus just kill, kill, kill. We saw that with I Know What You Did Last Summer, and to an extent, The Faculty, maybe, with a little nods here and there. But, you know, it's one that almost could have been milked to the fullest extent, but it didn't. It realized the specialty of it and moved on. And even Williamson realized that in his writing, to kind of put a halt to it and move on to something that challenged him a little bit more. So I think this one did inspire a lot of films going forward. We saw a lot of those mystery slasher films from other writers, and it really did move along throughout the, I would say, 2007 to 2008, where it kind of capped off. So Williamson is almost a pioneer, if we don't take Wes Craven's New Nightmare, that I think really did plant the seed to this kind of film within a film. So I think Wes Craven should deserve a lot of credit to this, even though he was the director, not the writer. But New Nightmare did plant the seed to where this kind of satire or this kind of innovative movie was going to go. So Williamson just kind of capitalized on it.
Yeah, I think now at age 44, New Nightmare is my favorite Freddy movie. Because all growing up, it was Dream Warriors, right? But then when you get what the joke is with New Nightmare, when you get what the gimmick is and realize that it's very meta and that people have been doing it left and right nowadays without giving the proper credit to New Nightmare, 100%. You know, and I'm a huge Kevin Williamson fan, maybe not of all of his works, but of what he did for the industry as a screenwriter. However, I cannot give him full credit, because I think the real credit for this film and how teenagers were portrayed, not only by him, but then eventually people like J.J. Abrams, you know, going in and doing the Joyride film and then Felicity. And like, I think you have to owe all of that to two filmmakers in particular. You have to owe it to Richard Linklater and Kevin Smith, because they kind of originated this idea of the educated slacker, where they might not be college grads, they might even be high school grads, but they've got a thesaurical vocabulary, right? They speak right out of the dictionary. And Kevin Williamson took that and put it in the horror realm, where these kids, for the most part, speak more intelligently and eloquently than any teenager should. But that's important, because it suspends the disbelief of the dumb, stupid teenagers that get slashed in the 80s movies, where they're all just having sex, getting high, they're stupid, they're ignorant, and they get killed for it. This takes it up a notch, where we're not dealing with that type of teenager, especially when you have like the more intelligent ones, like the Jamie Kennedy role, right? So I think he really took that new era of 90s educated slacker filmmaking and threw a coat of horror slasher paint on it, but also living within the joke of we are in a horror movie and you, the audience, know you're in a slasher movie, and you are calling out the rules of slasher movies with the people in the movie. That was kind of lost on me at 15, but I've grown that appreciation as I've seen more movies and see what it's doing and the very stereotypical characters in it. And you, like I said, you can rinse, rewash, and replay that.
I think it works because we don't have those normal tropes here. We don't have the full frontal nudity. We don't have the cliche situations. We have characters calling out the cliche situations. We don't have characters having sex every 30 minutes to anticipate a kill. We have characters, like you said, that are smart enough. Our Randy character by Jamie Kennedy that is warning these characters and watching the movies as they play out. And the movie doesn't repeat what the dialogue is saying. And that's the smartest piece of it. it doesn't repeat the repeat. We don't see this over and over again. It tries to stand on its own of its individual horror, where we have these almost teenagers that are adults that speak intelligently. We don't find a goofiness to them, except for our Randy character that is the one that's the expert of horror movies, and everybody else is genuinely concerned. They don't want to open the door. They don't want to pick up the phone. They don't want to do these stupid things that we would see in slasher movies naturally. And one could say that horror has taught us that. But, and, you know, that's where I think we are really engulfed into these characters, is that there is a relatability of normality to them. Is they go along their lives. They play along. In reality, do we think a slasher is going to come out of the woods like in the movies? No, we don't. So they go along their lives and they just go. And that's part of the thrills of this movie, is they treat life like it's normal. Yes, there's murders happening, but we still have a questionable asset to, should we go party? Should we have friends over? Should we do any of these things? There is nothing but these teenagers being teenagers. And it's not in a stupid way, because we have the environment around them just saying, this can't be reality. But at the end, it is. We are watching a horror movie like we would our own lives if we were treated with this kind of serial killer slasher aspect to it. And that is, at the top of the mind, the brilliance to this.
The intelligence behind the motives of the script is what really gets me, because, yes, they do kind of play right into the stereotypical no-nos of horror films. Like, the whole idea of, like, okay, well, yes, people are getting killed, but there's safety in numbers, so we're going to have this party. If we're all together, he can't hurt us. Yet, the killer slash killers are aware of this, and then you see them get separated one by one in very stereotypical fashion, because the safety in numbers idea is great until you fall into the traditional cliches of horror movies. So it works on all those different levels, and as you get to be a more refined horror fan, you get it, and then you appreciate what the story is doing, because they think they got all figured out, but they don't. The killer is actually smarter. Which leads me to a couple questions. So I'll start with my questions first before I get into, like, the deeper nerdiness of the movie. So we know that Randy, the video store guy, is like the horror expert, right? He has all these great soliloquies about the horror rules, about horror films. It's almost like he has it figured out for the most part. If you haven't seen Scream by now, I'm not going to spoil who the killers are. You probably already know by now. But I think it's interesting that the killers seem to know so much, yet the killers don't really show any signs of being horror movie fans as big as Randy is. Now, I always was a little bit troubled by that, but at the same time, maybe that's what it's supposed to be. Like, you are supposed to be assuming that Randy could be the killer because he knows how to get through all of the rules and break the rules. They even hint at it now and then, right? They hint at everybody. Yet, the plan is actually a lot more diabolical, and in a way, I feel like a lot of it depends on blind luck, which again is the suspension of disbelief that it couldn't have been that methodical, because a lot of things have to happen by sheer luck in order for this plan to work. That's the point of don't pick this movie apart. Let it seem smart, but don't try and untangle it, because then it will fall apart. And that's the whole point of the movie. Like, they want you to think this way because you want it to work so badly that you don't want to poke at it and try and make sense of it, because it's not that kind of movie.
So I think there isn't an audience member alive that didn't suspect Randy or the boyfriend, because the movie dangles you along on between these two of who's going to be the killer. And I think that's the main catch to it, is you're deciding between the two, the horror movie fan or the boyfriend that Wes Craven intended to make, like, this dark look, sinister guy, boyfriend that
his last name is Loomis. Like, come on.
Like, it is a great bait and switch here. And I think I'm going to dangle my bell on credit that I called it at least one of the killers, because I think the main twist is nobody expected two killers here, that I called Stuart the killer the minute I realized this was a satire at a young age, where we have Randy saying, don't say, I'll be right back. And Lillard was so confident that he said it. And I was like, that's got to be the killer, because no other character in this movie is going against the rules of horror, instead of Neve Campbell towards the end. So, but this is where I think was the best audience reaction, is the shock factor of not just one killer, because everybody suspected one of the two between Randy and Billy, but right. Matthew Lillard to be incorporated in that, because he is that goofy character. He is that one that nobody suspected, because he is that jock kind of goofball character we see in high school. And I think that is the brilliance of it, is we can see those nuggets during rewatches, his looks during the video store. We can see little mysterious nods of this character. And then you're like, crap, how did I miss this? Because Wes Craven intended to pull the wool over our eyes.
I mean, I think Kevin Williamson did with the script, and then Wes Craven masterfully knew how to direct the script, because really, he was just directing things he'd already done before, right? But this time, he didn't have to take it so seriously, because it wasn't taking itself seriously. And I'm sure he loved that. There's lots of hidden humor in Wes Craven movies, and there's plenty of in this. Like, he knows how to not only create tension and horror with his filmmaking, but he also knows how to be lighthearted. Perfect example, there's a lot of funny scenes in New Nightmare that a lot of people just don't even think about. Okay, so here's the next part too, is the fact that this obviously has a generational gap in it, because the let's say teen Vogue cover quality stars of this movie, and then the bait and switch with Drew Barrymore, who at the time was the most popular actor in this film and was the main part of the marketing. Like, no one knew what the actual result of this character would be until the movie came out. And we didn't have spoilers back then. We didn't have TikTok videos. It was something that you'd have to like kind of sit on, but then it would come out and that would just make people see it even faster. It's like, what do you mean? She's on the poster. That's what happens to her. These days you wouldn't have a secret like that. It'd be out too fast, right? But also the generational gap of, like, you know, my mom saw this movie later down the road and she thought it was hilarious that Henry Winkler is the principal in the movie, because kids her age at that time, he was the Fonz. He was the coolest kid in school, and now he's the principal, right? So they knew how to really bridge the audiences, not just from like the teenagers that wanted to see it, the 20 somethings that had money and access to horror movies at video stores that were going to be really into it. And then the older generation that maybe grew up with the original Nightmare on Elm Street and the inside jokes that were being played in the film, like Billy Loomis's last name being Loomis and having Henry Winkler as a principal, right, who gets slaughtered. Fantastic. I think that that's the real intelligence of this movie. But like you said, it was a sleeper hit, right? Like, no one expected this to be a monster. I remember seeing it maybe 2 or 3 weeks after it was out. It was at the Dollar Theater, and the Dollar Theater kept it for months. I think they might have even put it back into like the main repertory theater again, because it was such a sleeper hit and it stayed in theaters for so long, to the point where I feel like it was just barely out of the Dollar Theater when Part 2 came out. Like, that's the kind of movie it was, and we don't see that anymore, where the longevity of a film in a theater could go on for literal months, and this was one of them.
Well, you look at the cameos, we can't forget Wes Craven as the Freddy Krueger janitor that Henry goes at.
Wearing the sweater and everything.
That's so over the top, you can't help but just have fun with it. But this is one that I think is brilliant marketing when it came out, and I appreciated it, and I think it would irritate audiences now, having the main character, the main marketing aspect of Drew Barrymore die in the first 10, 15 minutes. But here's the thing. You can't be mad at this one, because it is one of the most memorable pieces of the movie. It's the most memorable scene. It sets the tone of the entire movie of what to kind of expect. So there is no other scene in a horror movie that has been mimicked more than the Drew Barrymore scene. And I think that is something that was a gamble, but I think it's something that's appreciated now. And, you know, I love that aspect. When you think Scream, It's almost you go back to the Drew Barrymore opening scene. You can't have it without it. So it's a well-deserved credit to the cast and the movie poster, I would say. But it's one of those that I think played off of, because I wish this, to an extent, would have come out earlier. I wish this would have been an October release. But at the same time, I think that's what grew the popularity a lot more. This could have been lost in a lot of October movies, but to gamble with this movie 5 days before Christmas on a horror satire, that's confidence from a studio to say, this will be a hit. I guarantee it. People are just going to gradually just warm up to this movie. And that's exactly what we saw from dollar, $2 theaters to video releases. This is one of those followings that deserves every bit of credit, from its filmmaking bravery to its imagination to its entire intent of what this movie and where it's going to go deserves. So I think this is one that, you know what, it's not just good filmmaking, it's good marketing. It's everything, the marketing package that the filmmakers deserve every bit of credit for.
Well, the filmmakers and the marketers, because that was a huge marketing risk and it paid off big. It could have easily not. Like, it could have easily just floundered and oops, you know, we're not going to do that again. And then we don't get the horror boom of the late 90s that we ended up getting, right? And I'm sure we'll talk about Scream 2 eventually on this show, but I mean, again, what a sequel. A superior sequel in a lot of people's opinions, mine being one of them. But I just remember that the Scream video cassette was always checked out at Blockbuster, and My Good Time Video, always checked out, right? So they knew they had something big and they had to get a sequel out there fast. And they did fast track it. It was like, what, a year and a half, boom, we got the sequel. And for a fast track sequel, it really holds up. Can't say the same for part three, you know? I usually am a defender of the threes and threequels. Not so much on that case. I'm not saying it's terrible, but how can you live up to the first two? 100%. So let's get off of like just the fanboying for a second, because we know that we like the movie for what it is and what it does. Before we get to our critics, do you think that it is a good movie for everyone? That's the question that I think we're going to ask ourselves as these critics talk about their opinion of the film, is that sometimes, and this is something that you've said to me many times, the objectivity you have to bring to a critique as a critic talking to everyone, like, how do you disassociate that from, let's say, an all audience perspective, or let's say all audiences watching at the movies or the Siskel and Ebert show, versus the audience that really wants to see this movie, teenagers, early 20s, and kids that don't have an ID to get in yet but want to see it? What's your opinion on that?
This is where this movie really does, I think, teeter, where it's going to be a fine line, because me personally, I love a good horror. I love a good slasher. I love a good time. But this is one that reinvented slasher horror whodunit. And when it comes to intertwining all three of those elements, the whodunit is the one to pull in multiple audiences to really kind of follow along, check some boxes, is mainly in a first-time view, and even a second-time view to see what you missed, to follow along with this mystery. So this is one, when it comes to a vast opinion of, is it just for gore? Is it just for horror? Is it just for thrills? Or is it just to solve a mystery? This one includes everything. So if you can forgive the horror, the slasher, the gore, and just go along with the mystery, you check almost all the boxes here. You take Nev Campbell, who's not the damsel in distress here. She actually does have some empowerment, and you want to follow the Nev Campbell character to solve this mystery, not necessarily all the other characters. Those are just kind of, let's pay attention to the body language, but Campbell is the one that we're really focused on to kind of take us along this journey of this mystery. And I think that's the secret sauce to this movie. Is it just isn't horror, just not gore, it doesn't go for the shock factor. It really does appease vast audiences. So is it going to be for everybody? No movie is, but it will check a lot of boxes off of pure entertainment. If you don't appreciate the gore, you'll appreciate the mystery, because this is a really good mystery. So
right.
I think, you know what? It appeases more audience members than not.
I mean, that is like the special sauce on movies like this, right? Where you take the Scooby-Doo element of who's the person behind the mask. A lot of our slasher films of the 80s didn't give us that, right? Like with the exception of Friday the 13th Part 1, where we didn't really know who the killer was, but then we did for every one after that. We knew that Freddy was the killer. A lot of the slashers, we knew exactly who the bad guy was. There were a few that were mysteries, like, okay, well, who's behind the mask? But it does Scooby-Doo it. It's like, who is wearing the mask? Oh, there's two people wearing the mask. That will always be that extra special sauce in a slasher movie when you don't know who your killer is. You have a facade, a shape that is chasing people around and slashing them. But who's behind the mask always adds tension to the movie. So I think that was the extra that this was, instead of having like a mutant guy or the escaped convict be it, right? But what did our critics have to say about that? Let's find out.
All teenagers go to a lot of horror movies, except for the teenagers who are in horror movies. They've never seen a single one. That's why they always make the same stupid mistakes that always get teenagers killed in horror movies. Wes Craven is a director who has made a lot of slasher films. His credits include Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, and A Nightmare on Elm Street. And now he's made Scream, a picture about a slasher terrorizing a group of teenagers who are horror movie fans and already know what to do and what not to do. I have seen lots of horror films, and I did enjoy it because, for once, the teenagers weren't making the same old stupid mistakes. Nope, they were making new stupid mistakes.
Yeah, well, I've seen a lot of horror films, too, probably the same exact number as you, and I didn't get into the picture. I don't think it's really as much of a clever satire as you're suggesting, because I think that it starts out as a slasher film and then adds this other material, this knowing material, but you still have to sit there, even if you're hip to the satire, Roger, and watch girls being stalked, ripped apart, and it isn't fun. So the attitude that I brought, which is always neutral to a picture, was depressed at the 25-minute mark in this film, and I, you know, smiled knowingly at what the film was saying, but I didn't learn anything.
I don't think it starts out as a slasher film. It starts out already as a satire. For example, the use of the big glass patio doors in the background for the telephone call. Yeah.
Well, while you're noticing the glass patio doors being shattered,
I'm noticing the fact that they're there.
Okay. And I'm noticing a body getting shattered. And I'm not going on the high horse against you. I'm just saying... No. I'm saying that that's what I noticed, and I found it offensive.
Okay, would you have enjoyed this more if the characters had not been savvy?
No, it would have been a worse picture, but I'm not recommending it.
I mean, I don't know what I was expecting from Gene. I was thinking that the knowing that you are in a satire, the knowing that you're in a horror film, was going to make him change his opinion that he's always had on slasher films, especially ones where women get ripped apart. But no, he broke open the same old bullshit case of excuses of why horror movies are terrible and how they're violent and misogynistic against women, and didn't even give any credit to the self-awareness of the movie. He just walked right over it. I didn't know what else to expect, but I should have expected that.
What I didn't expect is a comment like, I didn't learn anything from Scream. That is something I don't think should have taken place during a Scream review. What are you going to learn from a movie that's true intent is to be a horror movie about a horror movies or movies? So
right.
This one, he went into this one with the name of the filmmaker. He went into this one with the title of Scream. He went into this one with the main antagonist of the costume killer, and he knew he was going to hate this movie. So he was Debbie Downer from the get-go. And when you go into this movie with the intent of knowing it's a slasher movie, you see that first act where it's intended to have that, like Roger said, a satire of a horror movie. You're just going to go kind of downhill. And he gets it wrong here, because it's not just women being slaughtered here. It's everybody. And it's no female in danger the entire extent. We had this argument with Friday the 13th. By the end of the movie, our women, our females, are the heroes of the movie. So this is one I don't understand, where he just Either he falls asleep and he just assumes that every slasher horror movie is the same, or he just really wants this movie to fail because he doesn't want to accept it. He doesn't want to get it. But I am sick and tired of hearing the female in danger with movies that don't have a true outcome of just a two-hour slaughter fest of females, because that's not what this is. It is smart, but as we get into Gene's analysis of horror movies, he wants to ignore the dialogue.
He doesn't even consider the movies, and that's the problem, right? Like, that's the biggest problem I think I've had with Gene when it comes to the horror genre. He's kind of like that on sci-fi too, but he's a little bit more forgiving on, let's say, existential and esoteric sci-fi, is that he doesn't even consider these movies. He feels like he's wasting his time watching a horror film. And that's so disrespectful to the craft, where, again, like with Roger at least respects the craft, sometimes to a fault, because it could be like a really well-made production, but a bad movie in his opinion. He'll still at least appreciate the cinematography, the music, the editing. He did it with Yanks, right? Like, he loved the way that Yanks looked. He just didn't like Yanks, and that's fine. There's so many movies that he does that to, where Gene just has like this stop sign. It's a horror movie. I'm not going to give it any respect. I'm not going to give it any credibility. What's it even doing on my show? The fact that they dedicated full episodes to how terrible slasher movies are is that it proves that point. I don't think that was Roger's idea. I think that was Gene's idea to bring to the table, honestly. But yeah, that's my biggest problem with Gene sometimes, is that I'm never not surprised when he just totally disregards a horror film before even like getting the chance to have a discourse about it. He just shits on it. And this, my personal opinion film, I think this film was ready for that. I think this film knew in what it was, how it was made, how it was written, and at this point, as it was being reviewed by critics, that it already had a strong word of mouth. So there's no bad press that could hurt this movie at this point. So I'm sure they were like, yeah, tear us apart, Gene. You're just going to help us even more, right? And in a way, kind of did.
Well, not only did it, but we've seen this from prior movies that you use keywords from a review like slasher, dismemberment. It's only going to help the genre. It's only going to help the film. So in a way, Gene, kind of in his negative review, probably did help this movie, because when you go to look at a horror movie, you're not looking at feel good kind of words. You're not like hearing the feel good movie of the year. You want those words like gore.
It's a heartwarming slasher film.
So in a way, I think Gene is criticizing, but at the same time giving listeners, viewers, and readers what they want to hear. So I think after rewatches, this is one of those movies, if I were to assume after he saw the sequel, he would go back and change his review. But Gene has never really, in my research, gone back and changed a review. So, but I think this one he appreciated later down the road, but he wouldn't change it.
Well, I mean, I think the way he looks at it is the way that like people in the 50s viewed rock music, right? Especially musicians. It's like, they're only playing three chords and it's verse, chorus, verse, chorus. That's not music. That's nonsense. But it changed everything. And that's what this film did. This film literally reignited the flame of horror, slasher, suspense film until current times. Like, it hasn't stopped. It might have slowed down a little bit or maybe been too experimental, but it never stopped. And this movie is what really kicked it into high gear. I don't think there's a horror fan that will dispute that. They're like, yeah, horror was kind of done in the early 90s, right? Like, it wasn't a big box office draw. This brought it back. And it had all those emulations of it with the I Know What You Did Last Summer movies and Valentine's Day, all those, right? It's all Scream. It's got a different mask, but it's all Scream. But Roger kind of appreciates it, right? Like, he gets it. Roger gets the movie.
So he does, because like you said, he does appreciate it. He appreciates what the intent is trying to do. And I think this is where I think critics really did have almost an intent. We had the marketing. We had the marketing targeting towards this mysterious killer, but we left out the mystery. And Roger looked at a lot of the things that really did add to the mystery. The behind the scenes, the intimate shots, the score is fantastic when it comes to this, how we're leading up to it. The score doesn't give anything away. And I wish Roger would have mentioned that in his video review, that it doesn't go down the route of the Halloween score, the Friday the 13th score, the Nightmare on Elm Street score, where we can kind of see things coming. This is a journey of a horror movie that really does go back. I'll go back to my main point, the mystery point of it. And I wish either one of them would have appreciated that point, because that is a prominent aspect. That is a prominent selling point of this movie that leads to the twist that most people didn't expect at the end of it. And that's what really changes this from a standard slasher movie to something that is innovative. Is we don't get two killers. We don't get a up front and center killer. This is something that utilizes every element of filmmaking, from lighting to tone to the camera movement, to really add to that mystery. It's not just the dialogue from Williamson. It's everything that just really works together to build that satisfying ending.
And what's interesting too about it is that the film doesn't necessarily set itself up for a sequel, yet it's had a slew of sequels. And I think that's brilliant. I think it was brilliant of both Williamson and Craven to be like, hey, if this is a hit, it could be a sequel. But let's not be that movie that says dot, dot, dot at the end to build up to one. No, let's continue this story, but have to literally create it from the ground up, because we killed a bunch of people in the first one, and it's not like they're coming back, right? I feel like that's something that was so magical in its introduction to this genre. However, it was hard for it to outdo itself as more sequels came, right? Like, how could you justify so many sequels, and how can you keep using the same trick over and over again? Eventually, it's going to tire out. And how many horror films have we seen since then that were so sure they were going to get a sequel and then didn't, right? It kind of ruins the ending. And what I like about at least the first three Scream movies is they have definite stopping points. So if they don't get a sequel, I'm good. And if they do, cool. I want to see how they did it. But it's not like, oh, are they going to get a sequel? Is it going to happen? I don't know. They left the dot, dot, dot at the end. And I just think that's kind of brilliant filmmaking.
Well, what's brilliant about it is that every other slasher, from Freddy to Jason, they had stopping points too. Everybody, they usually die at the end, but they still keep going. And that's what right. makes the second one even more brilliant, that I won't get ahead of myself. We'll talk about later. But that's what makes this kind of satire, this franchise, whatever it may be. I'm just considering the first three, for example, so special, is because they have stopping points and they build on previous movies of these stopping points to recognize exactly what it is we have to challenge ourselves to where we're going to take this to the next step. We're going to make fun of the sequel. We're going to make fun of the threequel. So all of them are,
we're going to make fun of the imaginary movie within a movie franchise they built, the Stab franchise, right? That's brilliant. We'll get into that in part two, but I'm almost saying, hey, I'm ready for an actual Stab movie. I'd go see it. Like, that's what I'm talking about, is like the world building in this, by not taking itself too seriously, can lead to so many possibilities. And we don't see a lot of horror franchises that are willing to do that, other than Nightmare on Elm Street with what it did with New Nightmare. Like, that is a perfect example.
100%, because this is one where if we have these movies that leave the cliffhanger at the end, that's where we get a lack of imagination and it becomes lazy. So give us something of a stopping point, challenge the writers. And again, we're talking a movie from 1996 all the way, I think, to the third, 2004, correct me. But this is one that really does hold the flag. They say, let's stop the ridiculous generic shit and actually have a stopping point to challenge the next writer that's going to write this. So, and that can go true for horror, that can go true for comedy, that can go true for anything. So Scream doesn't get enough credit in its filmmaking ability, rather than just the audience reaction of shock factor, the mystery, et cetera, et cetera. there is a lot of brilliant examples here of how to challenge future writers to do better.
And I strongly suggest people go listen to, there's an episode of Mick Garris's Postmortem podcast where he interviewed Kevin Williamson for like an hour and a half. And he literally gave all the secrets and spilled all the tea of how he came up with the ideas for these movies. And I'm telling you, it's a lot simpler than we thought, and that's what makes it amazing. It was literally like cut and paste, but it worked. It doesn't feel that way. So yeah, if you're a big fan of Scream, go check out that episode. But yeah, this is, I think, a very important movie for the 90s. It's a very important film for the horror trend that would follow. I mean, we have horror cons now because of this movie, right? We still have generic Scream ghost face masks at Spirit Halloween every year. Like, it's not going anywhere. Okay, so as for the critiques of our critics, well, man, like, Gene, I'm sorry, man, like, you're getting an F on this one. It's a big F because he doesn't even give it the credibility of being a movie. Like, I really thought that this was going to be the slasher film that would turn him around a little bit and say, hey, we can be as self-aware of what we're doing, and it's going to be fun for you, the audience, to know what we're doing. We're inviting you into the movie. You're not just in the theater watching. You're actually a part of it now. That was such a novelty, and he didn't even give it any credit. Instead, he shakes it off. He's like, yeah, no. I was aware of the awareness of it, and I just didn't think that was that special. Get out of here. I bet you did. But you didn't want to break your streak of hating slasher films that you've carried for the last 20 years.
So with Roger, here's kind of the deal. Roger hits all the points, and I'm kind of disappointed because it feels like Gene's critique lasted a little bit longer than Roger's. And there is
too much time.
It did, because Roger was on the right track. He was going into the appreciation mode, and it's hard for me because I'm going to give him a positive review, but at the same time, there's lingering disappointment, not at fault of Roger, but at Gene, because there is a lot more to say about this movie in this review to audiences and to people wanting to see it than what Gene wanted to give credit to. So, but at the same time, I can't give him perfection because this is the movie I wanted Roger to go on the high horse for and say, shut up and listen to why this movie should be seen. Because of the uniqueness. Right. But at the end of the day, I'm giving him a solid 3 stars. It would have been perfection if he went to battle for this movie.
3 stars is great. If he would have fought as hard as he did for Cop and a Half for this movie, or the fight that they had over Full Metal Jacket for this movie, right? That's my point. This should have been one of those conversations, and it wasn't. So I agree. He loses a star for that because he should have gone for the throat on this one.
These are two that was all up on creative innovation, filmmaking innovation. You can't pick out another movie that doesn't involve technology during this time that didn't have some innovation in the horror aspect of it. And this is one that deserved to be argued for the pure creativity of innovation going forward. And that's something
awesome.
100%. And critics should have recognized this at this point and given credit where credit is due here.
I gotta tack this on. I'm mad at myself that I didn't put it in the conversation before the critique, but the expertise of the filmmaking in this movie, of how rudimentary it is, but it's all in the framing, the editing, and the flow of the film. You can make a scary movie if you know how to cut it in your mind before you're actually shooting it. And you don't see a lot of that style of filmmaking anymore. Everything's moving. Everything's on a jib. Everything's on a steady cam.
That's the way to end it, because you absolutely perfection of the description of it. So absolutely perfection.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad that you are starting off our October Spooky Fest, which I think is kind of going to bleed in a little bit into November, which is fine. There's only so many Thanksgiving movies that we can talk about, right? And we talked about two of the biggest ones last year. So we're good. We're going to bleed into November with some of our scary movies. So my pick, I'm going the sci-fi monster route for week 2 of this spooky October session. I am bringing the 1987 film The Hidden, starring Michael Nouri and Kyle MacLachlan. Very kind of underseen, underrated horror, body horror, monster horror movie. And I don't know what Siskel and Ebert thought about this film. I'm not even sure if you've seen this film. So we're going to wait until next week to find out. And with that, thank you for watching, listening. Please like, rate, review, subscribe, give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and then subscribe to our YouTube channel. Give us a great review on that and send us suggestions of films you'd like to see, as long as Siskel and Ebert covered them on their show. I'm Antonio of The Cult Worthy. You can find me at thecultworthy.com. My co-host Justin Henson, you can find over at
themoviewire.com.
And we will see you next week.
See you next week.